incredible. I mean, don't just believe me. Try it. It's amazing. And people, I mean, then they sit and they listen to an hour and a half or 2 hours of him giving a talk. And what do you talk about? Loving kindness, compassion, all these beautiful, wonderful things that if anyone else said, you know, I want to talk to you about loving kindness and compassion, they'd get up and walk out the door and say, what's on TV? And he talks to them for about an hour. Or he might talk to them about some profound philosophical thing, and at the end of the talk, they're all flying. And they come out and they say, and they'll walk up to me in the street and say, are you Buddhist? They say, I met the Dalai Lama. Oh, amazing. And they're not Buddhist or anything. I remember when he was coming to California, people would stop me at the checkout and they'd say, did you know the Dalai Lama was coming? And I'd say, yes. And they'd say, I got a ticket. It's the dream of my life. Take a moment to do Buddhism. It's really amazing. And then they'd say to me, so they come up to the sheet down and say, I don't know what happened. Is that I just looked into his eyes and I can't stop crying. I don't know what it was. They said, what is it about that guy? And I say, it's got nothing to do with him, actually. It's you. He just showed you something about yourself. He just helped you to connect with your own inner purity and goodness. He's just a mirror. He's just a mirror. It's not him, really. It's just helping people to connect with that inner clarity and beauty and goodness that's in all of us. You know, that we're looking for, that we want. I was in California and we were organizing these teachings by a Dalai Lama. We had a hall for 5,000 people. And all the tickets sold out. And the phones were just ringing 24 hours. And there just was a little article in the paper and that was it. But people heard he was coming and it just spread. And this is Silicon Valley. And Silicon Valley those days, I think, I'm not sure about now, but Silicon Valley those days was probably the richest, wealthiest place in the world. You know, there were guys there who were in their 20s, were billionaires. There was so much money coming so fast, huge houses, everybody. The brains and intelligence and know-how of computers was all focused in Silicon Valley. There was so much money. Of course, then it collapsed. And then the Dalai Lama's coming, and it's like, they all want to come. All these people with billions of dollars, and they want to come. They want to meet the Dalai. Why? Because they may have billions of dollars, but they don't have what he has, which is authentic goodness. You know, well, how can I say the words? I can say authentic goodness. I can say sincerity. I can say purity. I can say, you know, I mean, you all know what the words are. There are trillions of them. I mean, he's real. I mean, he is. What can I say? I mean, he's what we all want. It's what we're starving for. And it's not him. He's just living his truth. He's just a vehicle. As somebody said to me one time, he's like the moral conscience of the world. You know. I remember years ago, I was in London at the centre. And as I had done, passed through, he was going somewhere else, but they were having an audience with the Tibetan people. And somehow I got invited because I was a nun and I was at the center. And we're sitting in a little hall just like this, and it's mainly Tibetans, and he's sitting here, and I'm just sitting down there on the ground because I'm a nun, so I'm like right up close. And I remember I was sitting there and he was talking, and two thoughts came into my head. Very strange thoughts. The first was, why is he wearing those robes? And the second was, why is he talking in Tibetan? Like, why is he speaking that language? Quite simply because it's a kind of a transcendence, you know. I can't really slot him in and say he's Tibetan or he's a monk. He's not really. And of course it looks like that. But it's more, it's a symbol of something, isn't it? It's a symbol of living your truth. It's like Gandhi. It's like any of these great figures. They kind of transcend. Why? Because they live their truth. They are the goodness that they are. They're not scared to be the goodness and the magnificence that they are. And that is what we all are. But we've kind of gone away from it. And we need to be brought back there. We need to be shown the way back. And we're never going to find it outside of ourselves because it doesn't exist there. So no matter how much we have, no matter how much material, but we're never going to find it outside of ourselves, because it doesn't exist outside of ourselves. It has to be nurtured and developed within. I can't remember how I got to that subject. So Dalai says, look at affection. He said, you know, a small child, he said, everyone is drawn to those who have compassion. People are just drawn to it. And when we have kindness, when we have compassion in our minds, then we feel whole, we feel healthy, we connect. It's like the barriers go down. Why can you feel so close to Dharma? Because there's no barrier between you and him. He doesn't put up barriers. There are no barriers. There is no duality. There is no separation. It's like, you know, we put up so many barriers between ourselves and others, and he just takes them down. It's like, there is not this. So he says, look at the young child, the small baby from when it's born. If it's taken up and held with affection, then it grows healthily. And that's what it wants, right? It has a healthy growth. He said, this proves that our nature is kindness. That is what's natural to us. That's when we feel healthy, that's when we feel whole, that's when we feel fulfilled. On the other hand, a small child or even an animal, when there's hatred around, they run away. They get disturbed. So this is showing that this is out of sync, it's out of tune. So from the Buddhist point of view, see, our nature is good, it's pure. Like the sky, as the clouds dissolve back into the sky and you have this deep blue sky, what happens is that the sun just naturally shines everywhere without obstruction. And they say it's the same for us. As all these different disturbing thoughts and emotions and feelings subside from our minds, then the sun of our own natural goodness can shine forth and pervade without obstruction. And that's the goal. That is the ultimate healing. And the Sher says in his book, the very first chapter, the very first page, we're not moving very fast. I read the first line. I think I'll repeat it because this is the second line. Since healing essentially comes from our mind, not from our body, it's important to understand the nature of the mind. The intrinsic nature of the mind is pure, in the sense that it is not one with the faults of the mind, with the disturbing thoughts and obscurations. All the faults of our mind, our selfishness, ignorance, anger, attachment, guilt, and other disturbing thoughts, are temporary, not permanent and everlasting. And since the cause of our suffering, our disturbing thoughts and obscurations, is temporary, our suffering is also temporary. The mind is also empty of true existence, of existence from its own side. This quality of mind, known as Buddha nature, gives us the potential to free ourselves completely from all suffering, including disease, and the causes of suffering, and to achieve any happiness we wish, including the peerless happiness of enlightenment. Since the mind has all this potential, we do not need to feel depressed or hopeless. It's not as if we have to experience problems forever. We have incredible freedom to develop our mind in any way that we wish. It's simply a question of finding the right way to use the potential of our mind. So that's very clear, isn't it? It's our mind that creates our suffering. How? Well, we just got used so much to these bad habits, these minds arising, anger, attachment, clinging, and they just become very habitual. But they're not within the nature of the mind. And so from the Buddhist point of view, you see, you don't have to have all these things. You can dismantle this whole process. Like I was saying this morning about simplifying. You can simplify things. But it does take effort. It doesn't just happen by itself. Now this is the problem. If we have a habit to get angry and we don't do anything about it, it is never going to stop. We're never going to wake up one day and we're no longer angry. No. Because that arises due to habits and cause and conditions, and it becomes so habitual, it just becomes, we just do that, that's what we do automatically. So we have to kind of dismantle the causes, the condition, you see, we have to dismantle the causes. In which case, we actually need situations that make us angry, and problems, and difficulties. That we said this morning, because those are the ones which show us why we do things and how we do things. They show us why and how and what we need to do to dismantle. Now it's very hot. Has anyone got something they would like to say or any questions or anything? And I will tell a story. Anything? Anyone would like to say? Are they dealing with what I was this? Well, I want to tell a story because I think this is. I've been talking. Now there's a danger to become theoretical. So I want to come back to experience level. You know, what are we dealing with? I'm going to tell the angry young man story. How appropriate. Because it happened here. 3 years ago I was here, Naomi will remember, I was here doing retreat, and I was, she really came along to this episode. Anyway, I was doing retreat up here, and they asked me to give a talk. So I said, okay, well I'll give a talk about working with emotions, you know. So I was giving a talk about dealing with anger, I think. Why not? And there were just a few people, just a handful of people here. And I was talking all about anger and how it arises and the causes and how, you know, it's very destructive. And everyone agree anger's destructive? Yeah, okay. So that's great. So I was giving this talk about this. And then as the talk was going along, there was one young man sitting there on a chair. And the more I was talking about anger and how, you know, you can dismantle it this way and giving all these different things, the more restless he was. He was just moving to and fro from side to side. He was getting very, very restless. And finally he stuck up his hand and he said to me, "You're trying to tell me that there's something wrong with anger?" And I said, "Yeah, that's right." I said, "Well, I don't agree. I agree with you. I think anger is really, really healthy. Nothing wrong with it at all. In fact, I'm proud of my anger. In fact, my anger is what keeps me going." So I said, So I said, "Well, okay, you know, you might feel like that, but if you really check, you know, how is it with anger? I mean, how do you feel when you have anger and when you get angry? If you really check what it's like, it's not pleasant. It's very disturbing. It may seem like you've become more powerful, but actually your mind, your delusion just got stronger, and then you do things and blah, blah, and it's a very unhealthy mind. And if you habituate yourself to anger, you're going to suffer a lot. You're just never going to be happy in life. Believe me, you're never going to be happy in life." And you don't need to be angry. You don't have to be angry. You don't need anger in life. And I got very upset. And again he started arguing. He said, "No, you know, I disagree with you. I think anger is very important. I really cherish my anger. You know, it's what got me through." And then he started to tell his story. And his story was that when he was young, then of course, you know, he had been abused, And have they had all these painful experiences, and I guess you kind of keep them locked up for a long time. And then as he got older, then this, he started going back through that, and he said that it was only the anger that kept him going. He said it was the anger that fueled him to get through all this. It was only by holding on to his anger that he was able to get through. Is that clear? Did I explain that all right? Is that all right? Did you get that? So he said, I actually think my anger is very, very helpful. Because if I hadn't had my anger, I wouldn't have gotten through that. It was my anger that kept me going. So I said, well, you feel like that, but actually you don't need to have anger. You don't need to hold on to your anger. You can let go right now. You can let go of your anger. You can let go of your sad story right now. You don't need to hold on to it. Anyway, he got very upset and he stormed out the room. And people said to me, no, are you going to go out? And I said, no. And then when it finished, I went outside and he was waiting outside. And he came up to me. I started explaining again that he thought anger was really good. That was very important. And if he hadn't had his anger, he wouldn't have been able to get through all the suffering that he had. You know? And it seems like for many years he'd been going to all different kinds of therapies and talking about acting out and everything. But he says, my anger is what has got me through this experience. And I said, well, you know, you can feel like this, but still it is your decision to keep the anger. You don't have to keep it. You can let go of it. It's just a decision. You don't need to have anger. And anyway, so again, he was quite upset and he left. He drove off. And I didn't think I would see him again. We do have quite a bit of talk all about the stupa and different things, but I didn't think I would see him again. And then a couple of days later, he called. I was in retreat. He called and he said, can I come and see you? And I said, yeah, sure, I'm here for a few days. And he said, no, I want to come now. I said, okay, you can come now. So, you know, about 20 minutes later, the car screeches the halt outside the building up here. And I came down and we went for a walk and we walked to the stupa. And we were talking. And he said to me, you know, since we had that conversation a few days ago, and then he turned and he looked at me, and so I could see him. He said, since we had that conversation a few days ago, he said, I haven't been able to sleep at night. I was shaking. His whole body was shaking. And I was very scared. Do you know why he was scared? Yeah. I think it seems like nobody ever told him before that he didn't have to have the anger. I was very scared. Because I think some part of him understood that that was true. And didn't know how to replace it, you see. Because that was how he's identifying. His anger was his identity. So if I get rid of this, then what's left? The sad story. I'm not, please believe me, I'm not putting down all the suffering that he had. When I say sad story, we all have a sad story. We are all carrying around those sad stories. You know, I am not putting this down at all. And they cause us a lot of pain. But the problem was, you see, it had come to the point where if you let go of that, where was the identity? It had gone. There was nothing to identify with. It's like he didn't exist anymore. Because that was how he created his life, around that. Oh, it was a very powerful teaching for me. He's not the only person like that. We're actually all like that. We all have sad stories. We've all created identities for ourselves around them. And we cling on to them, we hold to them, you know, and we're actually very scared to let go. It's like I was talking last night about change and the importance of making a decision. I don't think it's easy to make a decision. Decision comes through a lot of reflecting and a lot of newborn awareness. When we really are prepared to be brutally honest and look at life and look at our lives and look at death, look at that reality that we're just every second, every moment heading towards death, then with that newborn awareness, then the wish to change can come. But it takes strength to change, you know, because we have created this identity and this script and this play, and we're acting it out, and it's comfortable. So, I would tell this story quite a lot because I found it very helpful to communicate something. Just the way that we cling, even though we don't see that we're doing it. And occasionally, there might be a small glimpse that it could be different, but it's quite scary, that glimpse. Don't think that it's necessarily liberating. For some people it might be liberating, yeah. Yeah, well, we're talking about the epiphanies, aren't we? Joy, he talks about epiphanies. Those moments when things just crack apart and you see something, you see how things could be different. But it's quite scary. And so I'll tell this story. I was in California and I was telling this story, and sometimes people get quite angry when I told the story. Or it produced quite a reaction. I actually got told off at one point. I said, don't tell the story. They said to me, don't tell the story. I said, well, I think it's quite good to tell the story. And another person said to me, you know, when you cling on to your anger, then you perpetuate abuse. You're abusing yourself. You're perpetuating yourself as a victim when you cling on to the past and what happened. It's true, isn't it? Maybe very sad things happen, but we cling on to them and then we perpetuate the sadness. We keep putting ourselves through it over and over again. It's quite amazing. Why do we do it? Why do we do it? Quite amazing. Then we wonder why we can't get enlightened straight away. It's so difficult just to get rid of the small experiences in our lives, small habits. It takes time to dismantle that process, that habit, even to see it. You see, this is why meditation is so vitally important, because in meditation, you see what Venerable Dhundrup is doing, is teaching a technique whereby you can just be clear and knowing with your mind. But what happens when you try to do that? All this restlessness and thoughts, and it's kind of like you suddenly realize you've got like 10-lane highways in your mind, you know, 5 lanes going this way and 5 going that way with all kinds of trucks and God, it's just so busy in there. There's so much going on. Well, that's not an accident that you're experiencing that. That's actually a good sign. It's a sign that you're seeing what you've not seen before. It's a sign you're becoming aware of the stuff you're carrying, the baggage you're carrying, do you see? I liken meditation sometimes to the fact that you've always lived in a room or a house. Let's say the house you were born in, you grew up in, and you've never left. You don't see that house anymore. And then one day a visitor comes. They say, you know, they say, can I come for tea? And you're kind of, oh, sure. And they come, and they're sitting there, and they're looking at the room, and they say, oh, I really like those 3 ducks flying up the wall. And you say, 3 ducks flying up the wall? Are there 3 ducks flying up the wall? Oh, yeah, 3 ducks flying. Where did you get them from? Where did I get them from? You don't see them anymore. You know, in your bedroom, it's like, they walk into your bedroom and it's packed. There's stuff under the bed, there's stuff on the wardrobe, there's stuff under the carpet. It's like, it's stuffed. Because there's all this stuff, and as you've grown up, you just kind of shunted it under somewhere and kept going, you see. You didn't spring clean, you didn't throw it out, you just kept moving with it. You remember the story in Bulgaria and the woman who got up because she couldn't, the anger? I mean, the person who made her angry is 1,000 miles away sitting pina colada, but she's carrying it all around with her. And if we don't do any cleanups, we go into death that way. We go into death carrying all this stuff, you know, and as you approach death, a lot of stuff starts getting very clear. Why? Because you don't want to be superficial anymore. and then you have to deal with this stuff. And then it's quite late to be dealing with it. Much nicer to do it now. So meditation helps you become aware. You just watch the thoughts which are coming up habitually, which are disturbing you. That will give you some clues as to what it is that you have to work with at the moment. It's not that when you start meditating, instantly you can concentrate, you know, perfectly. It's not like that. It's more that you get this awareness. And I was giving a talk on anger again. In the old days, I used to talk about this a lot. I kind of stopped to move on to other things, but those days I was in Singapore and I went to Indonesia and I was giving a talk there in this temple. And I was talking about anger and the thoughts of anger. And this one woman, she stuck up her hand to the back of the thing. She stuck up her hand and she asked this question. It was an amazing question, actually. She said, "But how do I know when I'm angry?" She said, "I agree with you, but how do I know when I'm angry?" And I was quite stunned. No one ever asked me that question before. How do I know when I'm angry? I thought, oh, that's very interesting. Good question, isn't it? And that's what we're dealing with. Many people don't know when they're angry. They don't even have that much awareness. It's like you say to somebody, "Why are you angry?" "So I'm not angry." "Well, why are you shouting?" "I'm not shouting." "Are you upset about something?" "No!" It's like all those guys in Florida who are suffering like mad, you know, and they're living their dream. You know, are you having a nice life? "Oh, this is my dream. I'm not suffering, so you can't do anything about it." So how do you know when you're angry? Well, you have to develop more awareness, more mindfulness. It's the same with desire. Many people don't even know when there's desire in the mind. You know, walking down the street and the next thing you know you're drinking cappuccino and eating a cake. But you didn't put it together that you sniffed coffee grinding. You know, why does nearly every cafe grind coffee? You know, so it spreads all over the place, you know, and have fat events sort of, you know, focused at the... I was in Auckland Harbour and they have this restaurant and the vent is like blasting out when you get off the Waiheke ferry. So like you walk past and your nose is just leading you in. You don't put it together that there was this and this and this and then that happened and then, you know, there you are and you're on your second cappuccino. There was no consciousness. I had a friend who's a monk and he went off meditating in Burma. The Lama told him, go to Burma and meditate. And so he went off and he, you know, went into this monastery. And he said when he first arrived there, he got a bit of a shock. He was Australian, he got a bit of a shock because he said, everyone is like, you know, they wake up like 3 a.m. or something and they go to the hall and they meditate. And they walk to the room and they walk to the dining room and they have breakfast and they go back and they meditate. And they walk and they have lunch and then they go back and meditate. He said they just never stop. And every distraction is taken away from you. And he was thinking, whoa. And then he said, you know, he started to do his meditation and he got into it. And he said, it was incredible. He said, it was really like that. You'd finish eating and you'd just walk back to the meditation hall because it became so addictive. You just didn't want to lose it. And after several months of this, he said, he just looked at the book and he saw, you know, what the Buddha said in the sutra, all the different signs that arise as your mind becomes peaceful. The example that we give, like, commonly is, like, the mind is like a glass of muddy water. When you shake it, normally it's being shaken all the time, so it's just filthy, you can't see through it. But if you don't shake it, it will just naturally settle and the clarity will appear. So he was reading his sutras and it's like, well, as your mind gets clearer, this and this happens. And he said it was happening. It was amazing. He said he could look at the wall and see the atoms. He would look at his arm and he would see the atoms in his arm moving around. He said it was really groovy. And he'd go to his meditation instructors and it was so blissful. He said, these young Abchans, and he said they would sit there and talk. He said, it was so blissful. He said, it was amazing. He was really enjoying it. And then he got this message came through that there was some friends of the family, quite important, were coming to Burma. And could he show them around? So he got permission to leave the monastery for 3 days to take them on a little tour. He hadn't been out of the monastery for several months. So He went out of the monastery and he says, walking down the road, and this is, do they still call it Rangoon? I don't know. They give everything new names. It's not Burma either, is it? Yangon, that's right. Was it Burma?
Myanmar,
that's right. Myanmar. I don't know if I want to call it Myanmar and Yangon, to be honest. I'll just stick with Burma and Rangoon. Yeah. So, he's walking down the street, and he said it was just unbelievable. He said a woman would walk past, or he'd look at a shop window, and he could feel this desire coming like a thunderstorm. He said he could actually feel it before it was in his mind. He could feel it sort of arising, because he'd been so, it's like the water had settled. So the dirt was at the bottom, and suddenly all this dirt is just coming up and just clouding. And he said, just wanted to run back to the monastery. He said, he just wanted to turn tail and run back to the monastery. He didn't want to have to deal with that. He said, you could feel the suffering of it, just overwhelming the mind. But most of us, we never get that experience, you see. We never get the experience of the innate purity of the mind. We don't have that experience. So, I got distracted. What was I talking about? Oh, this. So I was telling this story in California, and this one woman, she got upset. She said, well, a similar thing had happened to her. Unfortunately, this is so common as to be, I don't know, I can't even think of a word for it. Anyway, she was kind of in recovery because she had memories of abuse, and they had just surfaced maybe about 2 years ago. And she'd had to leave her job, and so much anger had come up, and she said the anger was helping her. And she said, so she's spending so much money on healthcare and on therapy, and America is very expensive. She's having to leave California. And she just got very upset, and she said to me, you're saying there's something wrong with anger? You know? I mean, you're telling me I shouldn't be angry? I said, look, I'm not telling you anything. Just check. Just check how it is when you're angry. Just check how it is. Does it help? Does it make you more happy? Is it really solving the problem? And she said, well, I know that being angry doesn't make me happy, but I really don't see anything else to identify with to get through this, to hold on to. And I said, well, why don't you hold on to your love instead? Why don't you identify with your love instead? Anyway, she went away. She wasn't very happy. She came back a few days later, and then we discussed it a bit more. She couldn't hear, you see. She couldn't hear because we can't hear, isn't it? Isn't it like that? We can't hear, or we don't want to hear. We can't hear because you're clinging to a certain way of things being. It's quite hard to hear. And she came back and we discussed it a bit more. And then when she realized I wasn't upset with her, you know, I was just saying, then she started to agree with me. And I said, look, the thing is that, and she said, I really want to help other people in this situation. And I said, look, if you really want to help, you must get rid of your anger, because as long as you've got anger in your mind, if you stand up there and talk about it and somebody laughs at you, you'll collapse. You're so weak. But once you've come through and you've let go of your anger and you've healed it, then even if people laugh at you, you won't care, because you're not vulnerable. Anger makes you very vulnerable, anger and hatred. They are not the solution in this world, anger and hatred. They don't work. These disturbing minds. 5 o'clock, am I supposed to finish at 5 o'clock? Oh, but it's enough, isn't it? What do you guys think is enough? Yeah. When the anger is coming up. It's quite difficult once anger's actually ripened. It's quite difficult when anger's actually come, you know. At that point, the best thing is go and count to 10. The old-fashioned method. Isn't it? It's hard, isn't it, when anger's already there. So So there are many antidotes, and there are many ways of thinking, but first you have to just calm the mind down. Because when the mind gets caught up in the anger, then it really is only seeing one way. And it's going over and over again justifying that one way. It's called unrealistic thinking. Technical term. Unrealistic thinking. It's the wheel stuck in the rut. You've got a certain way of viewing something, and you are just going over and over and over that, supporting it in every way. If you could use that same mind to meditate on the Buddhist teachings, you would get enlightened very fast. Unfortunately, we're habituated to use it in destructive ways. We're really, really good if somebody does something we don't like to go over and over all different angles, really examine it, and then come to a definite conclusion that they're bad, and then, you know, then like just like an electricity power station, you know, generating more and more electricity, we just generate more and more and more thought of how bad this person is. And we hold that thought, and it just abides there, and we kind of walk around with it, and everything we eat, sleep, and think is dominated by that thought. Isn't that true? So actually the other process is what we want to try and do. We want to try and generate the sense of the preciousness and the kindness of others. We want to try and... You cannot simultaneously have a positive and a negative mind. You can't have it at the same time. You can have one and then the other. So generally it's explained that if you try to keep your mind in a positive state of mind, then that will antidote it. But when anger has arisen, generally the first thing is try and calm it down, and at least don't do or say anything, if you can. That's always my advice. If you can't get rid of the anger, at least try not to say or do something. It's like pushing the first domino. When you push the first domino, all the others collapse. Isn't it? So even if you push the first one, try and catch it at the fifth. If you can't catch it at the fifth, try and catch it at the tenth. Did anyone else see this advert on TV with the penguins? It's so cute. Am I the only one who saw it? Come on. Penguin bites the crisp. Is that a polar bear?
It's a polar bear.
I thought it was a penguin. A polar bear dressed up as a penguin. Oh, the plot thickens. No, this is a penguin. And the penguin bites the crisp. And he goes, ah! Have you seen it? Yeah, it's true, is it? This penguin bites the crisp and he goes something like, oh, something like that. And he falls down, backwards. And then there's this endless string of penguins behind him. And they all topple down one after another and it gets to the edge of a cliff. And then that one topples down and pushes another whole load of penguins. Oh, come on, who's seen it? Not just one person. Yeah, you've seen it, right? Really cute, isn't it? So it's like that. When you at least try not to, even if you bite the crisp, at least try not to fall backwards. Because there's this endless series of penguins behind you that are all going to fall, and it gets much more complicated once you push the first domino. It's really complicated trying to catch it at the fifth and the tenth. Shantideva, this great Indian Buddhist master, he says, just be a piece of wood, you know. Just think you're a piece of wood. Don't go there. So Trungpa Rinpoche was asked this question. Trungpa Rinpoche, who was a great Buddhist master, he was asked this question. And he gave a really good answer. Somebody said to him, how do you deal with emotions? How do you deal with emotions in Buddhism? How do you deal with your emotions? And he said, don't express them and don't suppress them. Great, yeah? Well, so now it's great when you said that, so what do? Because from the Western point of view, we don't see any alternative other than those two. It's like, isn't that right? I think I'm English, so I was brought up to repress them. And then in Australia, you're brought up to express them, and I think New Zealand is quite British, isn't it? Anyone else going to volunteer that they were brought up to express them? Nobody going to volunteer that? Express them. Yeah, but then it's endlessly, you get it out endlessly. There's no end to getting it out. You just go over and over and over and make a habit of it. It never finishes, it never stops.
So what Trungpa just says is, don't express it, don't repress it. So what's left? Okay. Can you go back a step? If somebody said notice it, right? Yeah. Be aware. Isn't it like I was saying this morning? About trying to create this gap. When anger rises in the mind, it's so strong and it kind of overwhelms us. And that's exactly the point when we can start to try to make this gap, try to find a gap. Anger is arising, not for no reason. It's arising because you have actually decided, you know, you've actually written the script. Something happened and you decided to react with anger, like the samurai warrior, you know. Okay, you could say he didn't decide, it just happened, but it came from him, didn't it? Because even when he's standing there holding the sword over little Buddhist monk can say, oh no, I'm going to be killed. Little Buddhist monk just stays there. He's just there. He doesn't make up a story in reaction to this. He's just there watching. He's just observing. He's quite free, isn't he? It's quite interesting, isn't it? So it doesn't have to seize and overwhelm the mind. Quite interesting. You could. Not everybody could. No, finding the gap. I mean, one way is, you know, sometimes it happens, somebody does something, they criticize it or something like that, and it comes up like this, you know, this strong sense of comes up. You know that thing? There's a strong sense of comes up. And it's very solid and it's like here, and it comes up just whoosh, he said that to me, you know, whoosh, and it comes up, and then it comes up like this, and then what do? We go grab, we grab onto it, and then we do something to defend, because this is me, this is happening to me, and it shouldn't happen to me. So those moments, it's like somebody does something, and then the whoosh comes up, and you feel the whoosh, and you let go. You still have the whoosh, but you technical term. You still have the whoosh come up, but you let go. You just don't. You don't allow it to solidify and cling onto it and hold onto it. You just let it go. It's almost as. That's like observing it, isn't it? And you can do that because you know that you don't have to hold on. You don't have to go with it. It's just a habitual reaction to go that way. And you don't have to do that. So what happens in Buddhism, I mentioned this last night, I'm not going to talk too much more because there's a lot and it becomes too much, but what happens is, basically, we're in this process whereby our minds are just like infinite and spacious and open and kind of perfect in and of themselves. So we can achieve liberation. The Buddha said this. You know, there's not a single disturbing emotion that can't be eliminated from the mind. That we don't have to. We can come to a point where we never get angry again. We never. Just never controlled by our minds again. And at the moment, it's like a small child that's controlling us. It's like this child screaming all the time, and we're just falling around. My teacher gives the example. He says, "You don't have to do everything that the child says, but at the moment, our mind says something, and it's like this little crazy child, and we just do everything. We just do what it says. We just follow it around. You imagine two parents just following the kid around? That's what we do." Does that connect with you? Can you identify? You can see what I'm saying. My friends took me out to this restaurant, so I don't have kids, right? I'm a nun, I've been a nun for years, so not part of the job description. So I don't have that much experience. Anyway, my friends took me out to a restaurant in California. This is going to be your experience if you have kids. And it's this health food restaurant. And he's such a nice guy, and she's such a nice woman, and they're such adorable kids. I just love them. But I couldn't believe what happened. Basically, we had this most incredible lunch. They took me out for lunch, you know, and everyone had the most delicious lunch, and we were sitting there talking, and it was really nice. It was a nice environment. And then the little girl, who is an adorable little girl, decided she wanted a chocolate to finish off the meal. Oh, boy! It was amazing. Because why? Because Mom said no.